welcome to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast, where in every episode we explore what is research culture and what should it be. You'll hear thoughts and opinions from a range of contributors to help you change research culture into what you want it to be.
Hello, it's Nick, and for this episode of Research Culture Uncovered, I'm delighted to be talking to Josh Sendell about his library career, which has culminated recently in him being appointed librarian and keeper of the Brotherton Collection here at the University of Leeds Libraries. Josh's career in academic libraries started at Lancaster University, where he held roles including library aide, learning zone student advisor, information assistant, research data manager, and head of open research. He then joined the University of Nottingham as Associate Director for Research before moving to Leeds, first as Director of Library Services, and now as Librarian and Keeper of the Brotherton Collection. So hello, Josh, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Nick. It's great to be on the podcast. And I have to say, we've started out with what felt a bit like this is your life. It's always interesting having your career path reflected back to you.
I'm not going to introduce any surprise guests from your past, don't worry. But first of all, I mean, congratulations on your new role, which is still a very new role. And I think we should emphasise that it's the top job in the library. You're head of the library, if you like, I suppose. So congratulations on that. And as I say, it's still early days. How are you finding it so far?
Well, thank you, firstly, for the congratulations. I'm very much enjoying the role. It's a tremendous opportunity and indeed a privilege to step into this role, continue the work of my predecessors, and also work with the staff community to define what our strategic horizons look like moving forwards. And of course, I step into this role at a time of significant turmoil. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in terms of the pan-global political settlement. There's an awful lot going on at the moment. And of course, higher education isn't immune to the shock that we've seen that comes from those changes in the political arena and indeed some of the economic challenges that we're experiencing as well. So it's an interesting time to step into the role, but it's a time that's not without its challenges. However, I'm fortunate to be supported by an excellent library executive and leadership team, and indeed to work with so many great colleagues across libraries, collections and galleries. So it's a heady combination of optimism, excitement, but also pragmatic realism.
Right. Well, I mean, it's interesting.
I think I said pan geopolitical settlement, or something along those lines.
I'm going to write that down. But in that context, I mean, libraries are important, aren't they? Information is important in this current landscape. And obviously, we are privileged to be in a big research intensive university, one of the biggest research libraries in the UK, I think. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Of a similar size and scale to University of Manchester, Sheffield, Edinburgh, Glasgow. So yes, we are a major research library, and our collections are truly outstanding. Our cultural collections and also our main collections, and indeed the services we offer for our academic community, are progressive, forward thinking and grounded in being useful to our students and our academic colleagues as well. I'm biased, of course, but I fundamentally think that University of Leeds libraries are a great outfit.
Yeah, and of course, you've got lots of networks across the sector, haven't you? You mentioned some of those libraries, and without throwing out too many acronyms, I know you've got leadership roles with RL UK, it's Research Libraries UK, SCONAHL. I can't never remember what SCONAHL stands for. Do you know off the top of your head, SCONAHL Society?
Oh, I think in the midst of time, it was the Society for College and University Libraries. So includes around 160 HE organisations. Not just university libraries, yeah, but that broader HE sector.
And Academic Libraries North as well is another one. I was just looking at your biography. I mean, you and I have known each other, I think, for a few years now. I certainly met you when you were at Lancaster, then when we were, still working in the same space, really, named Research Data Management and Open Research. And I should say, a colleague of ours was intending to join us. This is a co-host, Ruth Winden, who colleagues, regular listeners will know, is a careers consultant with research here at the University of Leeds, and she was very interested in your, as am I, your, you know, your rapid trajectory. I mean, just looking back at some of those, you know, those wide range of jobs you had at Lancaster. So perhaps just tell us a little bit more about your academic and professional background and, you know, what brought you to this point now.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think the first thing to say is that I didn't go to university until I was 24. So I went as a mature student. I read law at Lancaster University. And my intention at that time was very much to go on to practice law. I had aspirations to be called to the bar and practice as a barrister. That shifted slightly during my undergrad degree, and I started to think more about qualifying as a solicitor and ideally working for a magic circle law firm. As I got to my second year and into my third year, I started to think seriously about accumulating some work experience, getting some work experience under my belt, and undertook placements with Lancashire County Councils in their legal services department with a small provincial but very well respected law firm in Lancaster, and my academic interests started to narrow. So I became particularly interested in commercial and corporate law, and I decided towards the end of my undergrad that I was going to undertake a research master's, and I was going to look at an area of commercial insolvency, particularly around asset tracing and freezing injunctions. Fast forward a little bit, and of course, freezing injunctions are very interesting at the moment because of their utility and application for the seizing of Russian assets following the Russo-Ukrainian war. But where I'm going with this is twofold. One was when I was getting towards the end of my undergrad degree and thinking about my master's, I wasn't too keen on the idea of taking on additional student debt, and I resolved to work over the summer in various different roles across the university, anything really that I could get my hands on. And so it was a really interesting summer, the final year of my degree. I worked for the careers team. I worked for the students' union in a campus supermarket and on a reuse and recycle project. I was working for the accommodation team as a temp. And I also was working for the library at Lancaster, initially as a library aide, similar to a shelving assistant, and also as a Learning Zone student advisor, which you mentioned. And two things became apparent to me. The first was that it was entirely possible to save enough over that summer to pay my fees for the master's. But the second was that I was thoroughly enjoying the HE environment. I was genuinely loving how diverse universities are. You know, as a student, you don't necessarily appreciate all of the operations that go on behind the scenes. You know, we are large corporate organizations with complex structures and a commercial acumen and all of the different professional service areas that enable us to deliver our academic mission. So I started to think about a career pathway that would see me work within a university rather than a practicing lawyer. At that time, it was a bit tricky to try and identify a clearly delineated career pathway that had equivalence to the training contract you'd undertake to become a solicitor, for example. And so the early part of my career in HE was really diverse, lots of different roles, lots of different experiences, lots of sideways moves. The other thing I mentioned, because there were two, the other thing I mentioned was that I also came to realize that within that HE environment, what I was enjoying most was my work in the libraries. I absolutely loved it. Of course, it was my second home because I was doing a research master's, and so I spent a lot of time in the library. But the more I learned, the more I realized I needed to learn. And I think it's Charles Darwin who's attributed as saying the joy of knowing things always goes on increasing the more you know. And that's certainly been true for me and the library sector. So my first full-time role was an information assistant. That's very similar to the customer services assistants roles we have at University of Leeds libraries. And then I actually left the library for what I sometimes refer to as the sad chapter in some respects, because it became clear that the advice I was receiving from one colleague in particular to progress in my career was to undertake a master's in librarianship and information science. And of course, at that time, I was just wrapping up my master's in law by research, and that prospect didn't fill me with joy. And so I thought to progress, I might have to move on out of the library for a short period of time. It was sad because I loved the library and I felt I was leaving, but it was also really interesting. I worked for the equivalent of our research and innovation services on a project that looked at post-award financial grant administration and streamlining that experience for our academic colleagues. What I didn't know at the time was that that would stand me in really good stead when the next role I progressed to became available in the library, and that was as a research data manager. So because I'd had that experience of the research life cycle, from the financial perspective, I was able to map the, if you like, RDM life cycle against what I'd learned. And I was able to evidence that at interview. And it also influenced the way that I developed our services moving forward. So that was my first, what we would refer to as professional role within the library. That's also when I met you. I think I met you at Internet Librarian International. Maybe it was 2017, 2018.
Oh, that's a long time. Anything before COVID, I can't remember. But no, I do know.
Oh,
I do
got
certainly
you.
know we did meet around that time. Yeah.
We did, yeah. And you were speaking about Wikimedia. So
What's on?
that
Yeah,
passion
that's
that
not like me.
I know, strange, but you know, it was very on brand, very on brand. And actually, that presentation you gave at that conference really got me very interested in the world of Wikimedia. But perhaps that's a conversation for another time. So I progressed from research data manager to a role that was initially referred to as research and scholarly communications manager. Later, we changed that to head of open research. That was a role that I loved, and it involved the leadership and management of our services for open publications, for FAIR data, for reproducibility, for research intelligence, citations, analytics, and the likes. And it was a role I really enjoyed at a university I really loved, but a great opportunity came up at University of Nottingham, which you touched on. And that was as associate director for research. It was a fixed term contract, and it was a bit of a risk, in a sense,
Was
moving
that in the
from
library
a,
then, or was
it was in the
that?
library. Yeah, absolutely. So my team were based at the George Green Library at University of Nottingham. But it was a risk, you know, it was a leap of faith in a sense, moving into a fixed term contract role, leaving behind a full time role. But it was a great move. It was a year in which I learned an awful lot. I moved from a research intensive institution to a very large research intensive institution. I worked with some amazing people. I learned so much. But as that fixed term contract started to draw to an end, an opportunity came up to apply for the role of Deputy University Librarian here at the University of Leeds. And I had to go for that opportunity. I'm so glad that I did. I thoroughly enjoy working at University of Leeds. It's an amazing institution. It's a challenging time, as I said at the outset, in higher education. But there's so much opportunity to make a positive difference in the world. And one of the things I love about University of Leeds is that focus on our contribution as a university to the UN SDGs. So the values alignment is really strong. After about 18 months in that role, my role shifted to Director of Library Services, and then I had the opportunity to apply for a secondment. And that saw me move into my current post, which is acting university librarian and keeper of the Brotherton collection. And one day I'll remember to brief before I convey that job title.
Yeah, it's a long one. I know. I mean, perhaps tell us just what is the Brotherton Collection?
The Brotherton collection is, I would describe it as a collection of global significance. It's an outstanding collection of manuscripts and cultural artifacts that includes everything from beautifully illuminated manuscripts to a first, second, third, and fourth folio of Shakespeare's works. There's Bronte material in there, wonderful poetry. It's an outstanding collection. It's one of our five collections that are designated as outstanding by Arts Council England, but the focus for that collection is very much English literature, and it is up there with some of the greatest collections, both in the United Kingdom but also globally. And we're doing some excellent work to digitize material, make it available where possible through the Digital Library Infrastructure Project. And if you haven't already had a conversation about that, you ought to have a conversation about that with our new acting director of library services, Claire Knowles.
Well, that was when I publish this, I'll put some show notes in and I'll make sure there's links, because so colleagues can explore some of that. As you say, some of it's been digitized, it's an ongoing project, but you know, I keep meaning to explore it in more detail myself. But just to come back to your sort of career, so yeah, thanks for that sort of description of your journey. And I suppose what strikes me with that is just the sheer breadth of experience that you had, and that then presumably informs your work to this day, I would think. I mean, can you tell us something about what you learned along that journey, and what you're continuing to learn, I suppose, and what you bring to your role now?
I guess what I would say is people will often ask you to provide an insight into your career journey with the hope that it's a path that they may be able to emulate. And I've always struggled with that concept in a sense, because it almost calls you to provide a calculated equation that you followed, that other people can follow. And the reality is that there was a significant amount of chaos and opportunity and serendipity, huge amount of hard work, no doubt, long hours. There was a career development theory which I discovered called planned happenstance. And when I happened across that, it really resonated for me, because it recognizes that career paths aren't straight and undeviating. They are convoluted, they are meandering, and that's very much been my experience. But it's not a model that sees you surrender yourself as a hostage to fortune. It recognizes that you have to be purposeful, curious, open to new opportunities, committed to learning and ongoing professional development throughout your career, but you also have to be responsive to the opportunities that come up and create opportunities where you can as well. So that model really worked for me, because I wasn't able to give people a calculated equation, a straight path. The chaos is something different. My career pathway looks a bit more like taking a ball of yarn and rolling it on an unlevel surface. And I think that's the reality that I would want to convey to listeners, is if you think that you'll be able to carve out a straight path, then my experience is that actually that path will look quite different. Perhaps you could say, with the benefit of hindsight, that it's artistic. You know, there's creativity there. And as a result, it's perhaps a more enjoyable experience because of the twists and the turns. So that's what I learned. What I learned is that the model of planned happenstance career development theory is one that really works when it's transposed on my lived experience throughout my career.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, as we've discussed, you've moved into a position of senior leadership fairly quickly. What's important to you in your role as a leader in leadership, and perhaps related to that, could you what's been your experience of leaders in your own journey?
What's important to me is, first and foremost, knowing your own humanity and recognizing that, like all human beings, you're fallible. So that's fundamental to me. There's a leadership theorist who I love, Brené Brown, And she talks about the importance of rumbling with vulnerability. Growth only happens, from my perspective, when you're willing to accept that you're going to learn along the way. So that's kind of my first reflection. My second is that a role like this is multifaceted. It's simultaneously about the leadership and governance of a professional service area, a large one, and that comes with the responsibility of effective financial management and stewardship, thinking sustainably about the development of the service, on understanding that the world in which we operate is influenced by different drivers. So I have to stay abreast of developments, both within the HE sector and beyond, whether it's, for example, Bridget Phillipson's statement in the House last week that touched on lifelong learning entitlements, or indeed it's a policy paper that provides a renewed emphasis on the importance of open research. It could be REF or TEF. All of these different drivers influence the way that I and my exec team lead our libraries. So it's a complex role because you're both a subject matter expert, although increasingly as you progress in your career, you have to become more of a generalist. It really is about your range, your aptitude and ability across a range of different attributes and capabilities that will make you an effective leader. So that generalist skill set becomes increasingly important, I find, the more senior you become. The now chief operating officer at the University of Birmingham, somebody who earlier on in my career was a really good mentor for me, once described careers as an hourglass. You start out as a generalist, you specialize mid-career, and if you choose to progress to more senior leadership positions, you become more of a generalist. So I think that's an important feature of my experience. And again, that's a model that has really come to life for me as I've progressed. What's important to me, though, is people, our people. My role is a role of service. Some people love the concept of servant leadership. Some people loathe it. I love it. I am in service of student education, I'm in service of research and innovation, and indeed civic and cultural engagement. And that sense that a university is fundamentally a social undertaking for the social good drives me day to day and influences the way that I work within this role. But I'm also a university leader. You know, that's an important feature of any head of professional services experience of the day-to-day, is that you are a service leader within your service. You represent your service within the institution, but you are also an institutional and sectoral leader in your domain. So it's a broad church, and I think we could talk probably for an hour about what the experience of heading up libraries, collections and galleries looks like.
Yeah, no, thanks, Josh. And related to that, I suppose, I just wanted to touch on, I mean, you already mentioned that you've got leadership roles in a range of organisations like RL UK and Scone, et cetera, where you've taken a bit of a leadership role in the EDI space, you know, equality, diversity and inclusion. I mean, could you tell us a little bit about what motivates you in that area?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I guess the first thing I would say is, for accessibility reasons, although this isn't a video podcast, but we're at a video podcast for accessibility reasons at the outset, should have given a bit of a statement about my positionality. So I'm a middle-aged black cisgender man. What you can't see is that I'm also a gay man and I'm neurodivergent. So I have both dyslexia and ADHD. And I grew up in a low-income single parent household following the death of my father when I was younger. And so those lived experiences are indivisible from the me that is Josh. You can't disconnect those experiences from my life. But those experiences have demonstrated to me the importance of taking care to consider and accommodate the different experiences people have, and the reality that there's significant inequity within many of our institutions, and indeed with the fabric of society. You know, that extends from the criminal justice system to education and beyond. And I feel, I used that phrase a moment ago, that universities are a social undertaking for the social good. I both feel and I know that universities have fundamentally transformed my life prospects. They've enriched my experience of being human, but navigating my own individual pathway through education and into higher education and then into work has also been characterized by instances of struggle, I think is the right word to use. And the reality is that we aspire to live in a society that's based on the principle of equality. The reality is that there are differences that people from minority, marginalized, and underrepresented communities and groups face. And it's my steadfast belief that while we should strive for the concept of equality, equity is necessary to provide adjustments that enable people from different backgrounds to progress. So my lived experience is partly what drives me to continue my work as an EDI leader, but also the recognition that we all stand to benefit. Mm-hmm. You know, when we think about things like diversity of thought, for example, the importance of people coming together to use their individual skill sets, attributes, and experiences to ideate, to innovate, to build on the shoulders of the giants on which we stand as the academy, those researchers that come before us. The greatest potential that we have to develop something forward-looking and progressive is to encompass the whole of humanity's ability. And that means that we have to truly embrace and accommodate people from different walks of life. Mm-hmm. It's also important to me, though, Nick, because my own lived experience isn't so dissimilar from some of our students. And the proudest moment, I think, for any HE practitioner is when you see somebody, an alumna, for example, crossing the graduation stage, completing that milestone in their educational journey. And I'm mindful that we still have an attainment gap, for example, for Black students, we still have an attainment gap for disabled students. And so the work of equity, diversity, and inclusion is also about ensuring that our students can progress and achieve their individual objectives as well. So I think it's a responsibility of every leader, but it's one that is personally very important to me.
No, well, thanks, Josh. That's, I mean, one thing that strikes me in what you've just said, and I suppose my experience of working with you and having known you for several years now, is openness. And I think, you know, that sort of openness of research, you know, we're both interested in working open research, but also that general openness, as you've just demonstrated, and how that intersects as well with EDI. I suppose that's one of my interests in the context of open research is the, you know, knowledge equity. We've got the knowledge equity you've already referred to, but the knowledge equity network here at the University of Leeds. That informs some of the work, if I can mention it again, Wikimedia, you know, and actually trying to tackle some of the biases in the knowledge environment of which Wikimedia and Wikipedia is part. It's part of the library strategy, isn't it? I mean, you've already been referring to these types of issues in terms of knowledge for all. But I don't know if you've got any, you know, passing thoughts on that intersection of open research, open education, and how that relates more broadly to EDI.
Yeah, but perhaps before I do, I always want to caveat my own openness by saying to listeners that the decision as to whether or not to be open about your own lived experience is a personal one. And I would never want to project onto others an expectation that they are perhaps as open as I am. It has to be a personal decision. So I just wanted to nuance the way in which I'm happy to rumble with vulnerability and say that you don't necessarily have to if you're a listener and that resonates. But openness. So, yes, there is absolutely an intersection between the world of open higher education and openness around EDI. And it's this, that when I walk around our libraries, occasionally I glance at our student cohort and then I ponder on the titles of the books on the shelves and the names on the spine. And the reality is that the diversity in terms of protected characteristics that we see in our student population isn't represented within the academy at large. It's not represented on the books on the shelves, as it were. And so that is a reality. You know, we've done some great work over the last couple of years around the 100 Black Women Professors Now program. You know, in 2018, there were, I think, 25 Black women professors in the UK. Fast forward, I think that number has roughly doubled. But, you know, we still aren't in triple figures, as I understand it. And that gives you a sense of the scale of the challenge. And what I have come to recognize is that for students, early career researchers who are from underrepresented groups and will focus on ethnicity, but for the moment, there is the experience of what theorists refer to as epistemic injustice. And that's something that compounds throughout your career. And the canon, the body of accumulated knowledge that we work with in the university library, contains such great insights, such great charting of the progress of humanity as a walking, talking, thinking being. But we've still so much work to do to ensure that the pipeline from student to early career researcher and beyond is one that sees individuals progress on the basis of ability alone. And that requires that approach that is one of equity, of acknowledging and accommodating different experiences. So there are other reasons why I think the synergies are strong. And, you know, you could talk about open publications, for example, and the importance of open peer review. You can talk about reproducible research. So these are areas where individuals from underrepresented backgrounds can potentially do something a little bit different, work in ways that align with their values. And this is important. You know, that point around value alignment is that it's hard not to accept the premise that open research as a concept is aligned with our values. For example, our motto at University of Leeds, and knowledge will be increased, that sense that the potential is greatest when the research is open. And there's nuance, you know, as open as necessary, or rather as open as possible, as closed as necessary, is a mantra we often repeat. So there is a lot of nuance. But the point I would make is that there's a values alignment. But we need the rewards and incentives piece to catch up with the principles that government and research funders want to see progressed around open research. And that sense that open research is the democratization of the development of research outputs, I think that's fundamental as well. It's democratic, it's open, it's transparent. So there's clearly an alignment in my mind. You know, others may have different opinions, but there's a definite crossover to my way of thinking between open research and EDI, because it moves things from the esoteric and dark and nebulous, hard to understand, into the open and the light. Now, I appreciate that that's a bit of a poetic portrayal, but you'll appreciate where I'm coming from, I think.
Yeah, no, thanks, Josh. I'm conscious a little bit of we're getting towards the end of our hour, so perhaps just bring it back to library careers and some of the challenges perhaps in libraries. You've already referred to, you know, all the, you know, as open as possible, as closed as necessary, as you say, is our mantra, and sort of the administrative sort of issues around that. But what are some of the other main challenges beyond, you know, equity issues that we've been talking about in the library sector? I mean, AI is a big one. Have we got time to just touch on the challenges of AI, which again intersects with openness, I think, and open research, and a big part of our strategic thinking, I think, at the moment, isn't it? Is there anything there? You know, we haven't got that much time left, so I'm not sure if you can sort of summarise some of the issues that we're thinking about in terms of AI. And how it relates to equity as well, actually, I think.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And, you know, perhaps it'll have to be a spoiler for another conversation, because one could talk for days on this topic. You know, what I would say is that technology has forever been about the extension and amplification of human capabilities. AI is just another technology. Libraries have existed since times immemorial and move with the time and the medium on which we capture, preserve and make available information. It's always shifted from cuneiform tablets to parchment to vellum to the codices to the internet. You know, we've always moved with the times, and we're continuing to move with the times as we see the development of AI. I mean, what I would say is that there are myriad copyright issues in the AI space. That's a prerequisite that any good library and information professional would start by acknowledging. But within the development of that technology has emerged a clear preference and trend for many students and indeed researchers around natural language approaches to search techniques. Now, I don't think that we've seen or will see the death of the Boolean string. I think advanced search techniques will remain important, but there is a preference for natural language searching. And so the way in which we make our collections available may need to shift as we move forwards. I would also say that initially, if you'd have asked me in October 2022, you know, as ChatGPT became freely available to the public, you know, one of my major concerns was that, again, aside from the copyright issues, that ChatGPT had swallowed the whole of the internet and was able to regurgitate it in a way that seemed to emulate human intelligence. But artificial intelligence is not artificial, and it's not intelligent. It is a technology. And it has useful applications. I've absolutely no doubt about that. Its semantic reasoning and ability to construct language effectively is incredibly impressive. So what we have to champion within libraries is our raison d'etre in many ways, you know, that we need to be able to draw on a body of evidence, on well-produced, rigorous research. And so what is important, I think, is the development of RAG as a technology, retrieval augmented artificial intelligence, that sees a large language model, Gen AI model layered on top of a research collection, mm-hmm. that enables you to follow the citation trail effectively. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of shifts, And as I say, this is probably a précis for another conversation, but you did ask about the EDI considerations that relate to AI. And it's always been the case that the availability of technologies is often wide-ranging, but your ability to access it is predetermined by whether or not you have enough cash in your pocket. And it is the case that technologies are now available to individuals who can afford to pay for them. And then the other big topic, definitely a conversation for another big day, is what I consider to be cul-de-sacking. It is the concept of a self-referential model. So what AI does is takes a body of knowledge that exists and extrapolates, it abstracts information. But if we take a few steps back to an earlier part of this conversation, we know now that the universities in which we live and work, they aren't as representative of society at large as we would like them to be. So what I mean by self-referential is within the entire accumulated body of knowledge in the UK, for example, we have around, say, 50, 60 Black women professors contributing to that knowledge. And so the issue of cul-de-sacking is that we perpetuate what already exists. So there are risks associated with a shift to AI as a technology that's widely applied across the sector. And like all risks, the work that we must do is to carefully engage with those and attempt to mitigate for those risks. Because what I don't want to do is to present a model of catastrophe. I genuinely think that AI holds significant potential for how we work within the HE environment. We just have to take care to remember that it's the human in the loop that must drive the loop.
Yeah, no, that's thanks, Josh. Very quickly, just I have one more question in the library space that I've been discussing with colleagues, and I promised a colleague to put to you. Is something that I've been thinking about quite a lot is bridging between open research and open education. You know, to me, you may disagree, but to me, they feel slightly siloed from one another, even though our strategy as a university, they tend to operate in separate spaces. I just wondered, finally, if you've got any thoughts on how we can perhaps bridge open research and open education, perhaps AI is part of that, I don't know.
I think it's a fair reflection that the wonder of a research intensive institution with a serious track record of delivering outstanding educational opportunities is that we tend to be organized along strategic lines that see us not differentiate, but specialize when it comes to, say, the governance of research and innovation or the governance of taught student education. And those are two worlds that intersect and enrich each other. That's important. But we have, for example, Research and Innovation Board that will consider topics relating to open access, to research data management. And then you have Taught Student Education Board, and it's interested in pedagogy and teaching practices and making open texts available, for example. So I don't know that they're siloed and competing. They're certainly complementary. But perhaps we need to do more work to join the dots up, because that point, the world-class research informs world-class educational opportunities, is compelling. So it's interesting, the formation of that question and the way in which it was posed actually gives me cause to pause and reflect on our current approaches, and also to have that same conversation with our open research group, for example, or our open educational resources group, and to take their thoughts on the topic. So there's a necessary degree of specialization perhaps at play because of the depth and complexity of both of those different areas. But if the goal is, and knowledge will be increased, then you have to think about how the one informs the other and how the other enriches the former. So what a great conversation for us to continue offline as well.
That's that is something that hopefully we can talk about in a bit more detail with you and I and other colleagues. But for now, I suppose just finally to ask if you've to return to the beginning of our conversation and your career thus far. I mean, can you? And I'm conscious actually as well. I did refer to your current role as the culmination. Perhaps it isn't. I don't know. Perhaps, I don't know if you've got any ambition beyond that. Perhaps you could tell us that. But do you have any top tips to give our listeners who perhaps work in libraries or in the university sector or elsewhere, and who are keen to move perhaps into the sector or into libraries through a sideways move? And any sort of final thoughts on what people could be thinking about in that area?
I've said it a lot, I think, throughout this conversation. I would invite any listener to reflect deeply on their values and also to know their own value as well. Understanding your motivations, what really drives you, is the essence of being able to work in ways that are authentic to you. And you need that alignment. We spend a significant amount of our waking days working. So understanding that you want to find ways to work that are true to you and provide you with a sense of purpose and satisfaction, I think, is the essence of having a meaningful and enjoyable career.
Great. Thanks very much, Joshua. Thanks very much for your time. I think we're just about the hour. I'm sure you've got plenty more meetings to go to today. So really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today. Thank you very much, and speak to you again.
My absolute pleasure, Nick. Thanks again. Cheers, and bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast. Please subscribe so you never miss out on our brand new episodes. And if you're enjoying the discussions, give us some love by dropping a 5-star rating and written review, as it helps other research culturists find us. And please share with a friend and show them how to subscribe. Thanks for listening, and here's to you and your research culture.